I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, a tattoo artist looks to comfort families of Wilmington's homicide victims by using his art. First, Pennsylvania's two U.S. senators visited Philadelphia today, urging that more be done to prevent terrorist attacks. The visits come after FBI Director James Comey said yesterday that Edward Archer's recent execution attempt on a Philadelphia officer is being investigated as a terror attack. Senator Bob Casey says the country is seeing the rise of a lone wolf problem, citing recent violence in San Bernardino as well as the Philadelphia attack. He says federal officials need to assume that similar attacks will happen and that better communication between local and federal authorities is needed. At a separate event, Senator Pat Toomey said the danger of radical Islamic terrorism is not limited to unrest abroad.
The dangers of radical Islamist terrorism are not limited to countries far away. It's not just the civil wars that are raging in the Middle East or attacks against civilians in Paris and Beirut and Jakarta, but it's attacks against Americans at Fort Hood and San Bernardino and now Philadelphia.
Philadelphia Mayor James Kenney emphasized that the probe into the Philadelphia shooting is not finished, warning the speculation is scaring people and putting them at risk. FBI Director James Comey says it does not appear as if Archer had connections to an overseas terrorist organization.
I want to be clear, though. I'm not saying there is no connection to a bigger group because we're not done looking. So far, we see no indication that he was part of a cell of some sort.
Comey addressed reporters today after debriefing local law enforcement leaders about the federal investigation into Archer, who police say attempted to assassinate Officer Jesse Harnett while he was on patrol. Comey says that Philadelphia is not a hotbed for radicalization, but notes that extremists, including the Islamic State group, have been encouraging those who are troubled to commit acts of violence toward police and military personnel through social media campaigns.
This is obviously the nature of the current terrorism threat. Your parents' Al-Qaeda was a threat focused on national landmarks, sophisticated, carefully chosen operatives, long-tail surveillance. This is about this group of savages in Syria and Iraq trying to motivate folks to kill people.
Veteran Pennsylvania lawmaker Mike Vereb won't be running for re-election to the state house this year. Vereb says he's leaving for personal reasons, but conservative groups say they've been targeting the Montgomery County Republican for considering a budget that included a tax increase. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports.
In the last few election cycles, conservative interest groups have backed primary challengers against candidates they say are too moderate for the Pennsylvania GOP. Consultant Ryan Shafiq says he was vetting a few primary candidates to run against Vereb when the state representative announced he'd be retiring.
There was a primary challenge effort taking shape, and money was definitely being committed.
Citizens Alliance for Pennsylvania, a conservative group with deep pockets, says it was also looking to support a primary challenger. Leo Knepper of Citizens Alliance says his group focused on Vereb last summer as someone likely to vote against their interests.
We had actually targeted Representative Vereb with a mail piece encouraging people to contact his office and let him know that they oppose a tax increase.
Conservative groups say the state representative's decision to drop out will change the landscape for the 2016 primary. Vereb says pushback from these groups has no bearing on his decision or the direction of the state Republican Party as a whole.
What these special interest groups should be focusing on is working on agendas and governing and not trying to destroy someone else's group's agenda.
But he does admit fatigue.
The bickering back and forth in Harrisburg over this budget clearly didn't help matters when I was making my decision.
And just because a group like Citizens Alliance throws money behind a challenger doesn't mean they end up in the state house. Only twice have they defeated a sitting Republican and won the general election. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
26 people were murdered last year in Wilmington, Delaware. Tattoo artist Aaron Black Picasso Ray has started painting portraits of some of the homicide victims, giving them to families hoping to help them heal. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports.
At his tattoo shop on Wilmington's west side, Aaron Ray, or Picasso as he's known locally, began to meet the families of local homicide victims. They would come in with a photo of their loved one and commission a rest in peace shirt.
After a while, it felt like almost like an undertaker, like it's a mortuary from doing all the rest in peace shirts.
So Picasso decided to paint memorial portraits for the families. He doesn't charge them anything. He just asks them to text him some photos and picks the most compelling one. So far, he's made 10 portraits. At his shop, Picasso shows me a picture of Thomas Cottingham, who went by the nickname Cannibal. He died while trying to save a woman and her baby during an armed attack in September.
That right there captured him. Got his jewelry, all his piercings.
But beyond the physical details, Picasso captured something about Cannibal's spirit. His face is luminous, and he looks like he's in on a well-planned, practical joke.
And the expression on his face is out of this world. It freaks out a lot of people that come in, because it's a lot of people that knew him. So they look at him, they look at the picture, and they say that's just like looking at him like he's alive right now.
Picasso says he does this work because he believes it will help the families heal. He presented the portraits to family members last month at a special event at Studio 2L, his tattoo shop.
When they actually see the painting, they're just like flabbergasted.
At Marquita Mangrum's house in Wilmington, one of Picasso's portraits hangs prominently above the TV. It's of her 19-year-old son, Raekwon, posing in the mirror before taking a selfie. Raekwon was killed in April. Mangrum says the gift of the portrait is deeply touching.
Well, it marked week 37 that my baby was gone. So it just, I don't know. Somebody else thought about it, not just me.
Dr. Lee Anderson, a psychologist and one of the founders of the Delaware Grief Awareness Consortium, says that's why Picasso's portraits are so important.
Something as simple as being remembered is huge when you are in grief, especially with sudden violent death.
Anderson says grief doesn't follow a timetable, and she says the paintings humanize Wilmington's crime problem.
It also makes the number, the statistics, a real face, a real image, a real person, rather than the next numbered homicide.
For Marquita Mangrum, Picasso's gift made her feel less alone.
And this painting says a lot. And it means a lot. I smiled. After a long year, I smiled again when I didn't think I could smile anymore.
For WHYY News, I'm Ann Hoffman.
Turning to this evening's headlines, Allentown's former city controller pleads guilty today to a conspiracy charge amid an FBI probe of government contracting in the city. Prosecutors say Mary Ellen Koval and others were involved in a bribery and kickback scheme. They allege an elected city official seeking statewide office demanded campaign contributions from vendors in exchange for city business. Koval was charged with taking part in the plot. Koval is the first elected official charged in the case. She was re-elected in November, but resigned last week. Delaware lawmakers have refused to try to override Governor Jack Markell's veto of a bill allowing students to opt out of standardized tests. The legislation would allow students to opt out of tests without repercussions. It was aimed in particular at the Smarter Balance Assessment, which is tied to Common Core standards championed by Markell. The governor has said that allowing students to opt out of standardized tests could marginalize the highest need students and threatens millions of dollars in federal funding. 40 degrees, partly cloudy skies at 6:15. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. The evening forecast, partly cloudy, low overnight around 33 degrees. Rebounding to 48 tomorrow under partly sunny skies. Sunday starts off rainy, then turning partly sunny by the afternoon. Saturday's high, 47. Still ahead, getting the facts straight on a medical drama is tough, especially if it's set during the Civil War.
I can't just call anybody and say, you know, so he's got a mini ball through his kidney and then there's lead still deposited. You know, I have to sort of find the answer myself.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Upland Country Day School, serving students in pre-kindergarten to ninth grade in Kennett Square, supports WHYY. Upland is committed to embracing the latest research in teaching and learning. Upland introduced the Harkness method of teaching in all middle school classes and will open the new Idea Center in fall 2016, two programs that will help change the face of education in Chester County. Full scholarships available for outstanding students. More at uplandcds.org.
Billionaires. Everyone wants to be one, and Showtime is trying to bring us a little closer.
We've been long fascinated by billionaires, by what it means to be a self-made billionaire. Because to us, they're American kings, they're oligarchs.
I'm Molly Wood. Who needs $1 billion anyway? Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Philadelphia's ever-changing skyline is the focus of Bradley Maugh in his capacity as co-editor of Hidden City Daily. Let's look now at the changes in terms of the loss of buildings in Philadelphia for 2015. Bradley, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Hidden City Daily started in 2011, and you've each year compiled this list. And though it's under the Nutter administration, I presume much of the loss took place prior to that.
Well, sure. Philadelphia has a pretty lengthy legacy in terms of demolishing historical structures. You can trace it back to the Jane Building, which was, for all intents and purposes, Philadelphia's first high-rise. That was in the early 1800s, and then everything we cleared out to create the Independence Mall. And we've been demolishing things for a long time.
The Convention Center comes to mind as well.
The Convention Center and the Convention Center expansion. We demolished 19 buildings in the expansion of the Convention Center from about 2007 till it opened in, 2010, I believe. They weren't all historically designated, but there were 19 buildings in total, including the Ray Street Firehouse, which used to be the fire department's headquarters. It was a beautiful Italianate building with really nice gargoyles on it. The Gilbert Building, Buck's Hardware. There were lots of buildings that were destroyed.
Let's turn to 2015. What are some of the key structures that are no longer with us?
Well, 2015, we lost quite a few, but none quite like the Boyd Theater. The Boyd was really, for lack of a better term, the poster child of preservation in Philadelphia over the past decade, because it was designated, but that designation only included the exterior, and it was the interior that made the Boyd so unique.
If listeners perhaps aren't aware, it's on Chestnut Street, I believe, built in 1928.
Correct, yes.
Art Deco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was the last of Philadelphia's movie palaces, and we've got some nice examples in the area, in Ambler and Bryn Mawr and others in the region. But in Philadelphia itself, and specifically in Center City, that was it.
Discuss the New Hope Temple Baptist Church, built in, I believe, 1893. Nee Union Baptist Church.
Union Baptist, right. So Union Baptist, the church where Marian Anderson learned to sing. This is really a great example of the new Philadelphia, so to speak, the 21st century Philadelphia. You have a church which takes up a large parcel, one big parcel, belongs to one organization, and it's bought out by a developer, and then one large parcel becomes 6 or 8 or 12 or 15 smaller parcels. A lot of bang for your buck if you're able to purchase a church.
Let's put this church in the broader context of church properties. And the Archdiocese most recently, told their parishes again to not assist in historic designation efforts for church buildings without their participation as well. What's the impetus behind that?
The wording of it was very interesting in saying like that the government was out of line in trying to protect these buildings, i.e. the Historical Commission. I think the impetus behind that is that the church is realizing that their demographics are shrinking. And you see a lot of church closures across the city. And so people who have gone to those churches, they don't want to see their own history go away or torn down.
Bradley, take us to West Philly, University City, and the controversy longstanding over the Levi-Leas Mansion built in 1853. it seemed for a while that they were going to come to an accord on a way to preserve.
Yeah, that's a really interesting example of the preservation battles that go on. Penn has really been raked over the coals by preservationists for their wanton destruction of buildings. But in this particular case, they had a plan that was in place that would have preserved the main part of that home and still had an apartment building built adjacent to it. But the neighbors didn't like that plan. And so Penn came back to the drawing board, and ultimately that building was demolished, and the apartments are still going to come.
Call it a plan or a progress, but it never stops what's already on the blueprint board for 2016 for buildings being demolished.
Well, William Penn High School is coming down. Mount Sinai Hospital in South Philadelphia. Penn Tower in West Philly, it's the 18-story building that's right behind the Penn Museum. That's coming down for further hospital complex expansion. The Whitman Chocolate Building across the street from the Mint at 5th and Race, that's going to come down for more housing. And we'll see what else the year has for us.
Bradley Maul, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Bradley Maul is co-editor of the Hidden City Daily, also the creator of Philly Skyline. As the final season of Downton Abbey plays out on WHYY-TV, PBS is rolling out another period drama, Mercy Street. The show, set in a Civil War hospital in Alexandria, Virginia, premieres this weekend. WHYY's Jeanette Beebe reports that the show's creator, a Princeton grad, is a stickler for medical accuracy.
Mercy Street is bloody. It's a hospital drama where the patients are soldiers and the doctors are inventing modern medicine. Sometimes the wounds need wrapping. Sometimes the limbs must be amputated. David Zabel is the co-creator, head writer, and showrunner of Mercy Street. He's an expert at Grisly Hospital TV. He studied theater at Princeton. Then he honed his chops on NBC's ER. Zabel says he tries to make TV that's intense and full of adrenaline, yet also medically accurate.
But I can't write the scene until I know the details and the precise facts. Because ultimately what I'll be able to do is look at what a doctor or a nurse actually wrote about the process in 1862 or 1863.
In this scene, Samuel, an African-American aide to a doctor played by McKinney Belcher, saves a soldier's life in the middle of the night. He shows Nurse Finney, played by Mary Winstead, how he can operate in an emergency, even with no doctors in sight.
There's the rupture. Now pinch the artery for me. I'll tie a loop around it, leave an end dangling out. That way a doctor can pull it a little every day until the threat rots off and the rupture is closed. If they don't know how, you gotta tell them. It's called a ligature.
How will we know if it worked?
It'll work. I've done it before.
With Mercy Street, Zabel is obsessive about getting the medical facts right. But the show is set in 1862, which means the jargon is even more obscure than modern medical textbooks. Zabel says it's tough to nail down the details.
Well, ER was easier in a way because it was contemporary science. So it was easy for me to sort of call a doctor and say, all right, I've got this cardiology patient and I need, you know, this condition to go awry in some way. Can you explain to me how it could go awry and what the doctors could do to fix that? That was kind of easy. It's more difficult with Mercy Street because I can't just call anybody and say, you know, so he's got a mini ball through his kidney and, you know, and there's lead still deposited, you know, and I do a lot of digging myself. I have to sort of find the answer myself.
Dr. Robert Hicks is the director of the Mutter Museum of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. He served as an expert for the second season of the show, but PBS has yet to confirm whether it will pick up Mercy Street again next year. Hicks says that Civil War military hospitals founded emergency medicine as we know it today. Of course, Mercy Street isn't just a medical show. It's also about the chaos and changing roles of African Americans and women during the Civil War.
Well, it's good that women are coming into this television program in this way, but the historical reality is that it was a hard fight for women to get into hospital environments. But the Civil War is where it starts.
In the show, Samuel saves a soldier's life by tying a ligature. But he must keep his medical training a secret. Hicks says this scene is historically plausible. He says about 100 African-American men practiced medicine during the Civil War.
Dr. Barrison taught me things when I was little. Ever since, I just kept on learning.
Sable, the show's creator, says he wants Mercy Street to be accurate enough to be educational, but not at the expense of being entertaining. For WHYY News, I'm Jeanette Beebe.
You can catch the broadcast premiere of Mercy Street Sunday night at 10 on WHYY-TV. Finally tonight, oh gee, just got a text. Where was I? Finally tonight, hey, sorry about that. Phones have been abuzz since Visit Philadelphia released its own Philly-specific emoji keyboard yesterday. Now, if you're not familiar with emoji, they're those cute little cartoon images for text messaging that originated in Japan. The shareable emoticons have blown up in popularity over the past 2 years. They run the gamut from the classic smiley face to ghosts to bags of popcorn. Visit Philly's hoagie-mouthed emoji set features classics icons like Betsy Ross and a cheesesteak, though first prize for cutest Philly emoji is the Liberty Bell, shown expressing emotions like extreme happiness or just sporting a pair of cool shades. And it's only the beginning. One round of emojis isn't enough for the tourism organization. It says it plans to release more in the future. Their emoji keyboards work with both iOS and Android phones, but a warning to all social media mavens, they are not compatible with Twitter or Instagram. Well, I guess I'll just have to delete this tweet I was composing. It doesn't make any sense without a Ben Franklin emoji. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. In his State of the Union speech this week, President Barack Obama proposed a new initiative in fighting cancer. Vice President Joe Biden will unveil some of the details tomorrow in Philadelphia, and we'll hear from him on tomorrow night's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.